Hello, listeners. Welcome back to the NSMB podcast. This episode's guest is Ben Arnott, a World Cup downhill mechanic, engineer, and small business owner. Ben spent several years working as a lead mechanic for Trek World Racing and the YT Mob, and the stories from his time following the circus provide a fascinating look into the World Cup. For six of his years with the teams, Ben was also responsible for the team truck. He got to know it intimately while driving the large rig on the small European mountain roads to each venue. But Ben recently pulled back from wrenching for World Cup athletes like Greg Williamson, Angel Suarez, and more recently David Trummer. Instead, he's remained in Canada for the first summer since immigrating, and he's focused on sharpening his engineering skills with one-up components. He hasn't completely left the wrenching world either, and keeps his hands busy servicing products from Formula and EXT, which he imports through his distribution business, Alba. And while no longer wrenching on the World Cup, he's not saying it will never happen again. I'm AJ Barlas. Welcome to the latest NSMB podcast and my conversation with Ben Arnott. Yeah, hey, we're here today with Ben Arnott. How you doing, Ben?
Yeah, I'm really well. How are you?
You're pretty good. Pretty good. We're just at his Squamish, what would you call this, workshop?
Business? Yeah, let's call it HQ.
HQ. doing a bit of suspension stuff, and now we're jumping into a little podcast action. For those that don't know Ben is a World Cup, or was a, we'll talk about that,
yeah,
World Cup mechanic, working with guys like the YT Mob, and some others that we'll discuss. And he's an engineer at 1UP Components. Before that, you were at Cro-Mag,
yep.
And he runs his own distribution center. So part of what we're going to talk about is how the hell you have time to do anything.
Yeah.
But let's jump back to sort of a bit about you and like where you're from, because you're obviously not Canadian.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm from Scotland originally, and I moved over to Canada. I went to university in Scotland, and then a group of friends and I, most of them actually live over here now after trip, but we always discussed coming over for work and holiday after uni. So that was kind of our reward to ourselves for getting through university.
Yeah.
So in 2009, when I graduated, a group of six of us came out here and stayed in a rented a house in Whistler, which at the time was incredibly easy and cheap to do in the summer.
Right.
So nobody, even at that point, it wasn't anywhere near as popular. And I think we rented this really nice house in Blueberry Hill in a nice area. And I think I paid $700 for 100 nights.
Right.
So for three and a bit months.
Nothing.
And yeah. So we just came out here and I worked at Evolution, the shop in Whistler, and just had that first Whistler summer experience that a lot of people listening have probably had. And then that's the one you're always chasing, because it was just kind of work a little bit, ride bikes till the bike park closed, go out at night.
Party. Yeah.
It was amazing. So came out here for then, and then went back to Scotland because kind of thought I should try and do some engineering and kind of follow that career. If I left it too long and stayed out here, I might not ever be able to go back into it. So I went home and worked for, did what we call a graduate scheme at home. So okay. It's generally what you do when you finish university in engineering is find a graduate scheme with a established company. And it's like a training, I think they call it a engineering training here. And you do, they kind of do a bunch of training with you and kind of teach you how to
like on the job
be
stuff.
An engineer. Yeah. To kind of like take your university knowledge and apply it to actually working at a company. So I went home and did that for a couple of years, and I worked for a aerospace company at home, and they made some pretty cool in a way products like radar for the US Coast Guard planes and stuff. So I was working on like little parts of those products.
Okay.
But the company culture and kind of like, I don't think it was anything specific with this company, but a large engineering company culture just wasn't for me. Like the 9-to-5 office, kind of everybody there hated their job and complained about it all the time.
Right.
There were some old boys who'd been there for 50 years.
No way.
Since they were apprentices. And
were they about to retire, or do you think they were going to crack on?
They were about to retire.
Okay.
But if you can imagine, as a young engineer coming into a company like this, you're told, you're kind of like put in this position of authority straight away, above certain people who might have been there for 50 years, and you're told to change the way that they are laying out their workspace or how they do a certain process. And you can imagine how well that goes.
Yeah.
So for that reason and a number of other reasons, it just wasn't for me. And I kind of tried it and I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to Canada. So spend the next few years kind of doing jobs at bike shops and just other kind of jobs with the intention of coming back out here, and I moved back out permanently in 2014.
Okay, so 5 years later.
Yeah.
Huh. So how, like, you're in school for engineering. You finish and basically, you take a summer off, not a full year.
Yeah.
Have a bit of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously rode bikes already, and your friends did too by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
How did that turn into working on the World Cup?
Yeah, so when I grew up in a place called Peebles, which is where the, like, you, most people in the bike industry might know it from where the EWS is in Scotland.
Right.
So it's kind of like the best place in Scotland, probably the UK, for mountain biking.
Right.
It's a huge, like, it's kind of like, it's one of the best places to ride probably in Europe in a lot of ways. It's like a really kind of happening place for mountain biking. So I just grew up with always mountain biking and road cycling as well. My dad was a big road cyclist, so it was just something I always did. And when I was a youngster, like at high school, I used to go to the local bike shop in Peebles and kind of bother them all the time and hang out there and just generally be a 12-year-old or
shop
however
rat.
Old it was. Yeah. And I ended up working there just through, like, after school kind of thing. And then it turned into, they had a branch in Peebles where I'm from, and then Edinburgh, which is 40 kilometers away, the main city in Scotland. So I ended up working between those two. Huh. And then I went to university in Edinburgh as well. So while I was there, I kept working at the shop.
Right.
And so I just had always worked on bikes and things. It was kind of, my dad taught me initially. And then I worked in a really busy shop where we worked on every kind of bike. And I think that's such a good way to learn. Because if you can fix like a 1960-something rally with a Sturmey Archer hub gear, then you can put parts on a downhill bike. It's kind of easy. So
yeah.
So that was kind of a good kind of education. And whilst I was at university, every summer that you get off, you get 3 months off or so, I always tried to apply for teams. It was always just something I'd wanted to do.
Right.
It seemed like a good fit. Like, I was quite scared about traveling at that point still. It kind of like scared me, the thought of going away on my own, but I still thought this would be a good way to kind of get into doing that. So I applied for teams every summer and just never got anywhere.
Huh.
And when I finished university, came to Whistler, went back to Scotland, did this engineering job that I didn't love. Towards the end of that job, as it was tailing, kind of like I realized I didn't want to be there anymore, I started looking again for these World Cup jobs and emailing everybody. And I would just go on the UCI website every year, publish the list of teams that are going to be competing that year.
Yeah.
And every year they had an email address for each team, which seemed like a gold mine to me.
Yeah.
So I just made an email and a resume and just emailed it to everybody. Sometimes heard back, but never anything too positive. But towards the end of this engineering job, I was emailing them and I got maybe 2 or 3 replies, and they said, hey, if you can come out to like Spain, or you can come to the south of England for 4 or 5 days and do a trial, then we might give you a job.
Right.
And at this engineering job, which I hated so much, I used to use all my leave in like the first 2 months of the year. So I was just like, I hated it. So I just take time off all the time. So
yeah.
I had no leave left. And I got to this point where I was like, I'm never going to be able to trial for one of these jobs if I stay at this other job.
Right.
So I just left that job, which was quite a hard decision. Yeah. My dad wasn't happy, but I did it and just kind of like worked at a bike shop again and kept applying and had some pretty good replies and was almost going to go and do a trial with Chain Reaction. Huh. And at the same time, Greg Williamson, who's a friend of mine from home, because everybody who mountain bikes in Scotland knows everyone. he got a ride on Trek World Racing. He'd had a really good year the year before, and he was going to be riding for them. And he contacted me and said that Martin, the team owner, had mentioned that they were going to be needing a mechanic for him.
Right.
Because one of the other guys, it was a big shake-up year the year after Gwyn left Trek.
Okay.
And so a lot of things changed. And there was space for some new riders and a new mechanic. So he asked me, and then I spoke to Martin. Martin said, yeah, you can come out to Belgium, which is where the head mechanic at the time lived, and build some bikes. And if that goes okay, you can then come to the US and build bikes with Monkey. And if that goes well, by that point, I think we would know that we're going to take you, but you're like with the team for the year.
Right.
And that was it. It went well in Belgium. I remember sitting in the airport in Edinburgh, said goodbye to my girlfriend at the time and was kind of like, I have no idea where I'm going. I don't know who this person is. I'm going to stay at his house and build bikes. I don't even know if I'm good enough to do this. Like I'd gone on the Trek website and memorized every torque value for like linkage and everything. I was like, cause they're going to ask that, you know, like as soon as I turn up. Anyway, I show up and like, not in any way saying that it wasn't like a tight ship, because it totally was, but things like memorizing torque values for linkage,
it's maybe a bit much
overboard. Like, so it went really well. And, yeah, that was it. That's how I kind of got my start. You dealt with
Trek World Racing, which is massive. Like straight away, you're in one of the biggest factory teams there are.
Yeah.
And then you stayed with Martin's teams from then on.
Yeah. So with Martin Whiteley owned Trek World Racing. So it wasn't a factory team, but it was Trek's only downhill team at the time. And so he was the team owner for that team. And so he, as a team owner, that's a third party to the like bike company itself.
Yeah.
He provides the whole infrastructure, all the vehicles, the staff, basically the team setup. They like it in a very simplified way. They give him X amount of money and he provides a race team.
Okay.
So I was part of that. I worked for Martin, but on the Trek team. And so, Martin ran Trek World Racing with me on it for another 3 years, I think, from when I started.
Okay.
So the first year I did that, I was mechanic for Greg. And then the next year, I started driving the truck and there was a couple of staff changes and I was a head mechanic for that team for the remainder of it.
Wow.
And then...
what's it mean as your head mechanic of a World Cup team?
So you have, compared to just being a mechanic as such, you're in charge of the other mechanics, kind of like coordinating them. And it also means a lot of behind the scenes work in the off season. So I would do all the ordering, all the forecasting for what we were going to need. And then during the year, keep track of all the inventory. And you're basically just a more kind of senior mechanic. And
But if something's out of, like if you run out of stuff, it's on you.
Yeah. So that would kind of be, that was pretty scary, especially in the first couple of years. Cause I'm just like, I don't really know how much stuff to order. And I'd kept a count of like in the previous years, how much things I'd gone through. And so I just like multiplied those, added a safety factor of like, I don't know, I think double everything. And it's pretty good because especially as a team like that, which has pretty high, it's like pretty high profile status.
Yeah.
You can ask for pretty ridiculous amounts of stuff and most sponsors would generally give you them. So within reason, you don't kind of take the piss, you just like, if you think you're going to need 60 wheels for the season, if you ask for 80, it's not like going to be a big problem.
Right.
So the first couple of years I probably went a bit overboard and then you just kind of cut it back to where you think you need. So yeah, there's a bit of that. And then you just kind of like, it's just a more kind of senior role. And kind of like with Martin as well, he would always talk to me. So like, you know, he'd obviously talk socially to the other mechanics, but if there's anything, any questions he needed answered about what happened that day or why we'd run out of this or what was going to happen, it would always be me he would speak to.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the position there, I guess.
Yeah, you had to keep everyone in check, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't ever like everyone, all the other mechanics we had have always been great, and most, you don't generally get a job on the circuit if you're not pretty good.
Yeah.
And it's not even that you're necessarily the best mechanic, because like no disrespect to any World Cup mechanics out there, but I don't think they're necessarily like the best mechanics you could ever find. That's not why they're there doing that job.
Right.
They're like a strange mix of like able to spend time away from home, able to not sleep that much, kind of like work under way less than ideal conditions.
Right.
So generally, if somebody was on the team, like, you know, you weren't going to have to be keeping somebody in line or anything. It was more just like coordinating stuff and figuring out when people had to be here and kind of just keeping an eye on things and making sure everything was running really smoothly.
Yeah, right. So less than ideal working conditions for that job, I guess, is what you mean.
Right? Yeah.
You're working with things that can't get dirty or anything, but you're kind of outside. You're in a tent, but it's kind of outside.
Yeah. Yeah, and you just have to be really reactive and flexible.
Right.
You know, the only people I've seen, the only personality kind of types I've seen struggle or not do well is people who are very like rigid in their kind of outlook on things.
Right.
You know, which a lot of people are like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't work when there's noise around you, which that's true of a lot of people, and it's not a big problem because most people can find a job where they don't have to have noise around them.
Right.
But if that's your case, you're probably not going to be stoked when Claudio's playing his drum kit in the Scott tent next door. Or, you know, this. So I think just being flexible and like kind of accommodating is a pretty key thing for the kind of inclement working conditions that you might face. But
so you did a lot of time with Trek and Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go from there? Did you move with Martin? Or?
Yeah, I just always... So when Trek was coming to an end...
we should say TWR.
TWR was coming to an end. We, you know, there's not much that goes on in the World Cup circuit that you don't... If you're within the circuit, there's not much that goes on that you don't hear about before it happens.
Yeah.
So I think probably that last season with Trek, we knew that Trek was going to go with the Atherins like months before it got announced.
Right.
So Martin's not a stupid guy and he was trying to figure out what to do next. And Martin's also a very like kind of realistic person, and he said to us all, he's like, hey, like, you know, this team is, as Trek World Racing is ending at the end of this year, I really hope there's going to be another team next year, but I don't know. So I want you all to know that if there is a team, you've all got jobs. But if there isn't, I might not be able to offer you a job next year.
Okay.
So we were all on board with that, and you know, it sucked, but we're like, I'm sure you'll figure.
This is part of the game, hey?
I'm sure you'll figure something out. And so at some point during that year, Martin and Aaron Gwynn resolved their differences and started chatting again.
Mm-hmm.
And the timing was perfect because Aaron was looking for a new team and had some ideas about how he wanted to run it. And he wanted to be a sort of co-owner as well as just a rider. So, and Martin was okay with that. And so behind the scenes, and I didn't really know what was going on, Martin kind of hinted that it was looking good for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And if I wanted to stay,
didn't know who with or anything yet.
I had a pretty good idea, but I don't think he ever told me.
Huh.
Again, you just pick up on stuff and But that one, I'd say that was quite a well-kept secret actually. And also it was a well-kept secret, and I don't think anyone expected Martin and Aaron to work together again
because
they kind of fell out pretty badly at the end of the Trek years.
Yeah.
So yeah. And then I guess at some point that winter, Martin told me that there was going to be this YT team. He was going to be running it with Aaron. Did I want to come along and be a mechanic on that team?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, definitely. Because like, I actually really liked working with Trek. They were like, on the whole, a pretty solid bunch of people, and met some really good people there.
Yeah.
And I really liked the bikes, which was kind of a turnaround, because before I started working for them, I kind of thought Trek were a bit like just hybrid kind of like town bikes. I didn't really think anything of their mountain bikes.
Yeah.
But they were actually a pretty, especially from coming for such a like average place for mountain biking, they make some pretty good mountain bikes.
Yeah.
So anyway, I liked working for them, and YT I knew next to nothing about.
Okay.
Other than I know people bought them at home. They're pretty popular because there's a lot of cheapskate Brits, yeah, like cheap bikes. But it didn't make me think that they weren't good bikes. I just knew that like that's where they kind of
that
like,
was basically
they
were, a business model.
Yeah, that's where they were positioned. But also the opportunity to work with Aaron or near Aaron was like pretty cool because he's one of the best of all time, and that doesn't seem like an opportunity you would like turn down.
Yeah. Did you know at that point that he was going to bring John with him, or did you expect that that would be what would happen?
I was never really under the impression that I was going to work with him.
Yeah.
And I think from the very start, I kind of knew. Yeah, Martin told me that it was because it was like young talent is YT.
Yeah.
There was going to be Aaron and a younger kind of like up and coming rider, and it was going to be Angel.
Okay.
And so Martin just spoke really highly of Angel and said like, you're going to really like him. And I was like, sweet. You know, like I've worked with a lot of different riders over the years, and I've built up a lot of close relationships with them, but I don't have my like one rider that I've always worked with. Mm-hmm. And, I quite enjoy the like learning how a new rider works. And so, yeah, I knew John was coming along. Mm-hmm. And spoke to them quite a lot before the team was released, because at that point they were still trying to figure out the spec of the bikes, because Aaron kind of had like pretty free rein on what parts he could choose. You know, he could approach most companies and say, I'm Aaron Gwynn,
yeah,
kind of want to try your stuff.
And yeah, he was still at that point, was he still like the weapon of winning everything, or had it started to have some injuries and stuff at that point?
Well, he'd come off.
That was Specialized.
That was him,
right?
Coming off Specialized. So the start of Specialized, I don't think, was super great for him.
Right.
And then towards the end, he started getting results.
Yeah.
But I think that bike, like the demo,
didn't work.
The old one was never a very good bike, really. It was really small and just odd. He was always trying to get the sizing right. And I think he had tried the YT and really, really got on with it.
All right.
And thought, wow, I can like, and Aaron's like, I'll never forget how calculated is maybe not the right word, but just he jumps on a bike and rides a lap on it and will be like, I can win a World Cup on that bike on his home track in California. And you're like, how do you know that? And at first I think I just was skeptical. I was like, I don't really believe that. But then I'd watch him say things at races like, if I get that rock garden right, I've got at least like 1.5 seconds in it. And I'm like, how can you know that? And then the next day he would get the rock garden right and go 1.5 seconds faster. And you're just like, okay, I think there's something going on here that I don't understand.
So
I was chatting to John and Aaron a lot of the time about getting that bike spec'd, and yeah, it kind of went from there. So then I was with the YT mob for 5 years.
5 years there. How long were you with TWR?
Three. So yeah, I did 8 years, I think, including last year, which was my last year so far.
We'll get into that more in a second. So you said that you worked with a range of riders, where you've got guys like JC, more or less, has always worked with Sam. John Hall's always worked with Aaron. But there are other mechanics that stick with a team owner or teams, even sponsors. So you went more that route where Whiteley had been really good for you.
Yeah.
And took you under his wing and you stuck with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt pretty loyal towards Martin because he took a chance on me in the first place, which was like, you know, kind of a risky thing to do. And then he just looked after me really well the whole time. Like, he was always something I really liked about Martin, or like about Martin and like about anyone who does this sort of thing, is like Martin knows his expertise and he knows his like skill set.
Right.
If you have a skill set that he doesn't have, he'll put his full trust into you.
Right.
So he isn't a mechanically minded person, I wouldn't say. You know, like he knows that if it comes to a mechanical, technical question, he just refers to his mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that in somebody. I think sometimes if people try to like put their hat into the ring for every single thing, it doesn't inspire confidence. And so I found Martin was like really kind of straight up like that. Really liked it.
It's good, eh? When someone can just, I try to do it with even home renovation stuff. It's like, I'm hiring you. You're the professional.
Totally.
I would like to see something like this. Just let me know if you need any help.
Totally. And I get it. Like, there's times at work where you should use your initiative and try and, you know, put your input into something that isn't your department strictly. Right. But more often than not, I find that's like counterproductive.
Mm.
And I think, you know, provided the person doesn't want to learn how to do the thing in question, it's better just to leave it to like people who are qualified at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds cool. He put a lot of trust in you guys.
Yeah.
With what you did.
And that's, I think that's like a, you kind of feel that and there's like a mutual respect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, relationships always work better when there's mutual respect. And I found working on Martin's teams, it was like a good thing. It's a great thing professionally. Like actually them working for his teams are always dialed and like, you know, stuff was just, you hear horror stories from other teams, like, you know, cars not at the airport to pick them up and riders waiting in the airport for hours, or hotels being booked for the wrong weekend, just stuff like that. And that would just like never happen in a million years, Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, it was a pretty good experience being on the team, like outside of racing.
Right.
We always stayed in like really nice hotels and we went on quite a few like trips outside of racing. Like the first year I joined, we did the final, I'll get this wrong, but one of the World Cups was in South Africa, the Pietermaritzburg one.
Right.
And when I was signing up for that job, and I already couldn't believe my luck that I was maybe going to go to a World Cup and work there.
Yeah.
Martin was like, oh, and if you're interested, we're going to go to Kenya for a week safari after this World Cup in South Africa. And I was just like, couldn't contain my excitement. I was like, yeah. And I was like, and like, do I have to pay for it? And he's like, no, it's all like on the team. And so like, there was a lot of cool stuff like that. And
sounds like he was good at rewarding you guys for the hard work. Like he actually recognizes there's a shit ton of hard work going on at the races.
Yeah. So yeah, I had over the years had quite a few offers to go with riders, and it was sometimes an incredibly hard decision because I was really, really invested and attached to these riders. But generally, if I couldn't go with them, or I didn't want to go with them, or not didn't want to, if I chose to stay with Martin, I was always really sure to know that they were going to go to a team and to have a mechanic that was going to look after them.
Right.
Like maybe if a rider that I was really invested in had gone to a team and there was not going to be a good mechanic for them, that might have changed my decision, but that never, that situation never happened. Like the kind of riders that would be on Trek or YT and then moved on, they were always going to like better or the same tier teams. So there's not, at that level, there's not really any bad mechanics or anything. So it's just going to be a case of them getting used to a new mechanic and
new setting.
Yeah, another thing I find as well, like Greg Williamson's a good friend of mine. When him and I worked together, it taught me that being friends with somebody before you get into this work situation with them isn't necessarily a good thing. And I have a struggle with conflict in general, so I would find it really hard when I wanted to tell them something seriously, like, you know, like you have to stop doing this or you need to do this. And we'd have been at dinner joking around half an hour earlier. I find it really hard.
Yeah.
So I always find it better from then on to like keep arm's length from people and you still are friends with them, but like you need to be able to say like, hey, like stop being an idiot, or they need to be able to say the same to you. It's not just one way. And so I think from that, like having that one rider, if I imagine if I had that for like 8 years, I'd be like really close friends with them.
Yeah.
And I'd probably struggle even more to kind of like be honest with them. So that, and that's like my personality. It's probably the at play there.
That's a good way to segue into some of the silly stuff you saw or some of the amazing stuff you saw. So maybe we'll start with the first season, because that would have been a real eye-opener, I guess, for you, being on the World Cups. Had you seen a World Cup race live before?
Yeah, I'd been to Fort William a number of times in Scotland, but never to this kind of extent.
You're like in it. You're not just there watching from the sides anymore.
Yeah. The first one I worked at, like I actually went to Hafjell in Norway in 2012, the year before I started with Trek. I kind of missed out on my earlier story.
Oh.
But Chris Ball, who runs EWS, he lives near me in Scotland, and we used to ride when we were younger. And at the time, Greg Williamson and Rory Cunningham were racing under the Scottish team. They didn't have like teams yet. Rory would go on to ride for Junior after that, and Greg would go on to ride for Trek World Racing. But for that race in Norway, Chris Ball had a Scottish cycling budget to bring a mechanic out and go there. So the four of us drove out to Norway from Scotland, and it was like the funnest, like stupidest trip ever. I still like, it was the one of those. Yeah, it was just brilliant.
Just packed in a van.
Yeah, just packed in a van, just being idiots. And and then I went to the race, and they both did really well. Like Greg got a really good result, which probably helped him get onto the Trek race afterward, the Trek World Racing team afterwards. So that was my first like experience working there, but that was really funny because I was like lowest of the low, like pitting out of the back of a van with, we might have had a tent, I can't remember. I remember like,
did you have rubber mats at least?
I don't think we did. We were like full ghetto. I had like, I didn't have my own toolbox at the time, so like Greg had brought his, and like I love Greg to bits, but he's like must have the worst toolbox in the world, and that's
he's
he would probably admit that. And so I was working out that, and I remember like I needed a bottom bracket for Ruri's bike because it was like worn out. I remember going up to the SRAM tent and kind of being like, hello, and like standing at the corner trying to get someone's attention. And then like, it's like, hey, this bottom bracket's worn out. It's Rory Cunningham, like, you know, junior world champ, total legend. And the guy was like, you know, he hummed and hawed for ages. And then he came back and he brought like this one tiny piece of the bottom bracket that could be replaced. And he's like, that'll probably fix it. And I was just like, oh, thanks. So I was like, and so it's funny to go to Trek the next year and you go up to a tent and they're like, oh yeah, sure, whatever you want. So that was my first kind of World Cup experience, really. But
did you feel that went pretty well? Did you, you must have learned a lot from it.
Yeah, it went really well because I didn't really know, like honestly, I didn't really know what I was doing other than how to work on bikes. And even like working on downhill bikes at that time, like I'd worked on very few in my life because I was working at this like repair shop in Edinburgh, which was a lot of cross-country race bikes and stuff, but a lot of commuters and not like downhill race bikes. So yeah, but I definitely learned a lot and enjoyed that a hell of a lot.
When you were applying for these jobs, did it matter whether it was an XC or DH team?
I only applied for DH, I think.
Okay.
I think I only wanted
that was what interested you.
XC seemed like, first of all, I just like, I actually used to race it when I was younger, but like kind of was put off it and just, you know, I didn't really want to work in it. Looked like a lot of hard work. Then it looked a bit easier and like way cooler and kind of like was more what I was into. Could see myself more at those races.
Yeah, it's what you're drawn to.
Yeah.
Working that first race in Hafjell, was there anything that caught you off guard? Like, were you surprised at how many wheels, I don't know how many wheels they bust in Hafjell, but was there anything that you're like, holy crap, I need to do heaps more of that than I thought? Or
I find it was full on because I was working for two riders there, kind of like two and a half actually, because there was a Fraser McGlone and his dad was like wrenching for him, but I was helping out a little bit as well.
Okay.
So it was full on, and also that we didn't have many spares, so it was really like, it was actually like more like what I would call being a bike mechanic. You're like trying to make stuff a wheel survive, you know, yeah, rather than just changing it.
Huh.
So yeah, I think is that, and then
this is pre-inserts too, right?
Yeah, this is like probably inner tubes. Yeah, essentially. Oh, yeah, well, some people would have been running tubeless, but the first 2 or 3 years of Trek World Racing, we were inner tubes.
Right.
It was actually sweet. So easy. Just like never had to deal with sealant, never had tires going down. Like, kind of miss those days a little bit. But yeah, I think just the like, I think actually probably the thing that struck me the most was like, it was really in my face because I had three riders there, definitely two riders and a kind of third. Was their emotions and dealing with them, because these are people that up until then I know in a fun way. We would go biking together, we like go to the pub together, and then to see them in their like race day mode, and it took me, you just have to learn the kind of nuances of how to like deal with somebody in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't good at it at the start, because I would just continue acting towards them exactly how it'd been that morning. But now you had to be in a different kind of like place with them, and like respect their kind of like quiet time and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think the kind of like, without sounding like I'm blowing my own trumpet, I think the bike mechanicing part is kind of easy. I was like, had loads of experience in that and felt super confident in it. It was just like how a race weekend goes together was like the kind of, and how the athletes
deal with it.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
And then coming into TWR, you're working with, I'm drawing a blank again, Williamson.
Yeah, Greg, yeah.
Did you continue that sort of learning process of, okay, this is just, I mean, you'd only done one World Cup race with him before. Was there still more of that learning, that process, that it is his time, his space, and all that kind of stuff?
Totally. And like, it didn't help as well that he was going through the same thing. It was the first team he'd ever been on,
right?
And he didn't really know how to like deal with those situations, because all of a sudden, and this happens so often in the racing world, whatever discipline it is, that riders like are desperately looking for this team deal, you know.
Yeah.
And they think it's all they want, and then they get it and they're like, shit, I have to like perform now. Before this, I could get drunk the night before, sleep in my van and race, and if you get a good result, everyone's like, and he did that result after being drunk and sleeping in his van. Whereas like on a team, you got no excuses. Like, our whole job as that team was to make that rider's experience as optimal as possible for racing.
Yeah.
So they had no excuses.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden you've like added this huge extra amount of pressure. So there's that, plus me learning how a World Cup works. But luckily I had Monkey, who's like
legend.
Yeah, like, you know, one of the most legendary World Cup mechanics, probably the most legendary World Cup mechanic there's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Had him to learn from. And then I had Sander, who was the head mechanic at the time, and he was like super dialed, like really knew how to do everything to the book. And so I just kind of watched them, and Sander would like, you know, he would make sure he came up with me to the start of the race and like show me like, hey, go over there, make sure you get your like the transponder chip for the fork, like do that as your first thing, go back, get the pits, the trainer set up, blah blah blah. So he took me under his wing like really well.
Yeah.
And then also you kind of like you get to know other mechanics and other teams. You might already know them from something before, but like you get to know them pretty quickly, and there's like the vast majority of them are super nice and will always help you out. And
yeah,
so
are you guys sharing tips on how to work something to make it do better, or like maybe a part doesn't do something like stock, but you tweak it
from other teams?
Yeah, like the mechanics, are they sharing information?
I think it's, there's case by case.
Yeah.
There's like some people who are like super coy about stuff, and
right,
it's all like mind games and stuff. I was always pretty open, like probably too much. Like I don't have that competitive kind of streak through me where I can like psych somebody out. I would just be like, oh, I see that thing's not working, this is what I did to fix it. And sometimes you tell them, be like, shit, I probably shouldn't have like been so open with that information.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know, I think that stuff, what goes around comes around. So I think on the whole, people are pretty open, and mechanics are like, we feel like we're in it together. You know, like the riders are a kind of separate entity and they're like all battling each other. But at the end of the day, we don't really have like a podium for how well we do. We have success or failure. There's no in between. It's like you supported the rider and set their bike up as best you could all week, and then it survived race day. It's that or something went wrong. So I think there's more of a like, and you don't want to see that. Like you don't, you know, even your least liked rider, you don't want to see their chain snap or something, because you think, oh man, their mechanic must be like kicking himself right now.
And you've been in the tent where that's happened, right?
Yeah.
How'd that go down?
I mean, it happens like loads, actually. Like you'll see something happen and you can, all mechanics that are there are all very in tune with like what that bike is doing at that point on the course, and you can all tell at the same time, oh man, his like something just broke or this just came undone or something. So it's it's a pretty grim feeling. But especially the last couple of years of World Cups, they started putting a TV in the warm-up tent or near it at the top, so all mechanics, you used to just like see your rider off and then bail out down the hill, especially before like iPhones and internet were like readily available everywhere,
right?
Because you would have to rush back down and see what the results were or hear them on the radio. Nowadays there's usually a TV at the top, so you can just watch it happening. So you'd be up there and you know, you might be standing with like whatever rider's mechanic having a beer that we'd brought up, and you see their chain snap and you're just like side-eyeing them, watching their reaction. Like depending on how proud they are, they might like just be like, yeah, that sucks, or break down into tears or whatever, and you just have to be like, man, I'm sorry, like that sucks, I know how that feels. And
it's like a little brotherhood.
I think it's really close to that. As I say, there's always exceptions, but like on the whole, it's like a really good like crew of people that like each other and will help each other. And there's a lot of that at the top. There's always like somebody forgot their pump, need to borrow a pump, like you know, oh, my trainer's still working, can I use yours? Or riders even like jumping on your training bike if it's, if your rider isn't there yet, you know. It's all, it's not, you know, it's probably getting more F1 every year, but it's still quite homegrown kind of.
So SRAM RockShox have tents support there, Fox have tents support there at the races. How much are you servicing suspension, for example? Do you do it yourself much on the race weekend, or is it really just sent over to the tent?
I was always working on Fox teams the whole time there. And I think RockShox is pretty similar from what I can gather.
Yeah.
But we, as a rule, wouldn't touch suspension. In the latter years there, like I'm pretty close with the Fox guys, and like used to, you know, we'd figure out riding trips after World Cups and stuff together. So got to know them pretty well. And also like so I would, whenever a new product come out, I would try and go over there when there was some downtime and just have them show me how to service it, just because I thought for tuning stuff, is for me, it always works really well to like know how something looks inside. So I actually ended up doing a bit of servicing there with them. And in the latter years, when they got really, really busy, you'd generally, the process is at the start of a World Cup weekend, the day before, you set your tent up and then grab the bikes out. They've usually been sitting there for a month, so they're kind of looking a bit sorry for themselves. And you'll like take the fork out, take it to Fox. They run through it, they just change the seals if they need it, service it as necessary. The rear shocks, you don't even really do anything with them generally, like a check cycle through it and check that it feels okay. But I think their kind of like outlook is, if it's within a race season old and it's working, it's better to keep it like working as it is,
and,
you know, rather than service it every round. So you, the reason we would service a rear shock is like the riders would go to like say Morzine between a couple of races and do like 10,000 runs of plenty, and like everything would be destroyed in their bike, including their shock. So you'd get it serviced in that case. But on the whole, it would just be once a week once a race week, get their fork serviced. But when they got really busy, I started doing that myself just to save time, really, and to not bother them with the extra work. And they were happy for us to do that. Huh. So, I mean, the suspension that we use is incredibly reliable. Can't think of a suspension failure the whole time I worked on the World Cup.
Yeah.
So it was just always keeping it fresh and
running at its tuning. Best.
And when it came to tuning of the suspension, the riders would have their base kind of bike settings from the off season. And at a race, they would, sometimes we'd adjust things, a couple of clicks here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, Fox liked to be kept abreast of what we're doing. So if it was one click or two clicks, was usually always two clicks, but if it was two clicks on something, I would just change it and keep a note of everything. If it was something more major, I would physically do the change, but we would both roll around to Fox and just chat to Jordy or whoever about it and just say, this is what we did. And they would be like, oh, okay, cool. Maybe you should do this or that. And so, yeah, that was the extent of it.
So you really, like you said earlier, you almost were doing more mechanic work when you were doing the two guys
at
the first race you ever did than main season.
Yeah.
There must be a lot of replacement parts, though.
Yeah, you do a lot of part replacing.
Yeah.
Part replacing is relatively easy for a mechanic. Most mechanics working in bike shops can do that effectively.
Yeah.
So that's, I wouldn't say is the difficult bit. The kind of difficult bit is knowing that when that bike rolls out of the pits every single time that it is working perfectly and nothing's going to fall off it, and that you're happy and confident that it's safe and performing the best it can for the rider.
Yeah.
And that sounds sure, I just have to do this. But you got to remember, sometimes if it's a muddy race and there was a red flag in practice that held up practice for an hour and a half. So now they have an hour and a half of practice left and it's 40 minutes a run to get on the lift and everything. Right. They've got a very limited amount of time. Their bike's coming in, it's covered in removable mud.
Yeah.
You have to clean it, do all that stuff, and be that same level of confidence within a mega short amount of time. Yeah. And so you kind of get to this state with a bike where the race bike in question, I just get so familiar with how it works and how things sound and feel when you shift something or you turn something or you wiggle something, that you kind of get this feeling that it's good. Right. And it's hard to explain because maybe I'm over complicating it, but I think that's what being good at that job is having that real deep confidence that it's good because you're just in tune with how it works.
Was it ever tricky trying to get riders specifics dialed in every race? You pull the bike out, you got to get the brake levers exactly how they like it, the bar roll exactly how they like it.
Yeah. And you see a huge variance in riders. Some of them are whatever, as long as it doesn't fall to bits, I'm fine. And some of them are incredibly particular.
Huh.
And it took me a long time to learn, going back to the fact I don't like conflict either, to say no to people and tell them to just get on with it. Because some personality types, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. So if you're hey, is your front brake feeling all right? I bled it for 4 hours and I think it's feeling really good. And they try it and they're you're waiting for the verdict and they're yeah, it's okay. And you're oh man, I could do it better. And then you spend another, and I did that for a long time and then watched other mechanics kind of being nope, I'm not doing that, or it's just good. Ride it, get on with it. And kind of trying to get the right balance between being brutal and also being good and accommodating. So
yeah.
Shit. Yeah.
So you said earlier too that you, when you were at Trek World Racing, started driving the truck, and from what I saw when you were at YT, you were still driving a truck. You became the truck guy.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Is that just what the head mechanic does on a World Cup circuit, or?
Not necessarily. Like, some teams have a driver, like some people use like a third party, like a
person that they hire. Yeah.
But it makes sense if your mechanics can do it too. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't specifically a thing that the head mechanic does, but just kind of as things went, Sander, the head mechanic when I started, he was a truck driver. And having one truck driver is a bit risky in case somebody like breaks their leg or can't go or something. So I think Martin kind of like asked if I wanted to do my truck test in one of those years, and I was like super keen, like I love driving and really wanted to drive a big truck.
Yeah.
So I did my test in Scotland, and then that next season Sander and I shared the driving, and he was like an amazing truck driver. Like he just super experienced and knew. It's like a weird type of truck driving because you have to drive into all these mental like ski resorts and like up these tiny
roads. I was going to ask you about the drives themselves.
You've got no business being. And so, yeah, like that was great because if I just had to be dropped into it on my own, it would have been really scary.
Right.
So, yeah, and then when Sander left, I was still the truck driver and the head mechanic as well. So
you just held on to that.
Yeah.
What's like a good story of driving a truck, whether bad or good? Like maybe the most petrifying moment you had driving one of those trucks.
Oh my God, I've had so many. So the year Sander left, the first race of the next year, I was with Eli, the mechanic who used to work with us. And we were driving from Martin's place in the south of Spain to Lourdes in France, which is basically the north of Spain. And for some reason, we got one later in the year. We didn't have a GPS, like a sat-nav thing. And I went on Google Maps and printed off the directions like you used to do back in the day when you're going on a road trip. You'd get like, you know, 18 pages of like, and it'd be like, turn left at this roundabout. And if you missed that roundabout, it messed your whole directions up. So I downloaded that, and just super naive and stupid, we set off and did the bit through Spain. Super cool, like really enjoyable drive, like just loving it. Like, and then stopped at some point, and in the motel we stayed at, I was kind of looking at the map, and I was like, man, there's this like big old mountain range between where we are and where Lourdes is, you know, the Pyrenees.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I don't know, Google probably knows what it's doing. So we like started driving, and in my later years I would know this as like a danger sign that all the houses start looking more like alpine chalets and less like kind of lowland houses. And the road starts kind of climbing, and you get out for a pee, and it's kind of cold, and you're like, oh, this is weird. And we kept driving, and anyway, we ended up in some ski resort in the Pyrenees, and there's snow everywhere at the side of the road.
Oh, shit.
And I was just like, what are we going to do? Because at this point, you can only drive a certain amount of hours in the day because of EU driving rules.
Okay.
And I had to be there to set the tent up. So I was like, if we continue on this road, which was still climbing at this point, we might not be able to, like there might be a bridge or there might be too much snow. But if I go back down towards Barcelona and go like around the Pyrenees, that's going to take too long. So just like sheer panic, like because you're in control of this like huge, heavy thing filled with bikes that these people need to race for their careers. Like it's just a career ending move if you don't get there on time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we just like, just decided like just gonna have to keep going. So we went up, and yeah, climbing through a ski resort, the snow on the ground, my first time driving this truck.
Is this fresh snow on the ground?
Yeah, like at the sides, like there's good like centimeter of snow, like because it was snowing at the time at one point. And the climb was okay. We got to the summit, it was like 3,000 something meters, or maybe not that high, high 2,000s, and was snowing, and we were just kind of laughing, but like, what are we doing? How are we gonna get down? And then descended down the other side, and that was just like a hairy alpine descent.
Yeah.
and all these like bridges where there are tunnels where they're blown out of like through a mountain. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, you go inside and it's just a, like rough rock walls. And they looked to me exactly the same height as the truck.
Oh shit.
So everyone I went through, you'd have to like go creep through, and there's a huge car, queue of cars behind you and cars coming towards you. And you're just like waiting to hear that noise. And yeah, so in the end we made it and it was fine.
No incidents,
but that was like baptism of fire into like truck driving to bike races in Europe. And so, yeah, I guess the next five or six years I drove it all around Europe. I think I did about 90,000K in it in total.
Wow.
There was many, many times like that. And just like, just figuring out like how to, or getting stuck in little towns. Like there was this process that would always happen. You'd be looking for somewhere to stay that night. You would like pick a place. You'd start driving towards it. And I would bargain in my mind. I'd be like, this looks like it's going to get really tight and skinny and low bridges, but I really want to go stay there and not stay in the truck or somewhere else on the side of the highway.
Yeah.
You'd start driving in, then you'd be like, ah, shit, this is going to be one of those ones. And then by the time you know it, you're like having to get locals to help you reverse out. And so, yeah, it was...
You just have to swallow your pride and get everyone involved and help you get out.
And it's a great thing about driving a truck that no one tells you when you're learning is that, like, at the end of the day, you're driving this big, massive truck, which, first of all, people are, like, intimidated by, so they really get out your way.
Right.
And secondly, like, people, like, they want to help you, like, get out of situations. Yeah. So like, yeah, generally, I don't know, by the end of driving it, I was like super confident. Just go anywhere and you still get stuck, but like it's part of the
you say the truck, was it the same truck all the time, just with new wraps on it?
Yeah, same truck. Huh. so
you got familiar with it? That's
yeah, the
sure.
Viking. It was a classic,
the Viking.
Yeah. It was owned by Team Maxxis, which was like a Spanish mountain bike team for a while.
Okay.
And they bought it brand new and then they sold it to Martin. Huh. And he's had it and I think he might be replacing it soon, but like it was great.
Huh.
It was like in terms of like big trucks or like people who are into Scanias, which is what it was. It was a total cherry because it was a 2001, but only had 200,000K on it. And usually by that point they would have like over a million.
Yeah.
So whenever you take it to a Scania garage, all the old Scania mechanics are like, whoa, it's so cool. Like, let us know if you ever sell it. You know, it's like so clean and all that. And yeah, nice. Sweet.
And what is it? Does Martin have a property or something, or does he store that at some joint?
Yeah, no, he's got a suite. He lives in a little mountaintop village near Granada in Spain.
Oh,
and
nice.
He bought a property a couple of years ago that he made this huge 12-meter long fence that can like open and then you reverse. It's a total techers maneuver to reverse it into there. But when you're in there, the gate closes and it's all in there. And yeah, so
keeps it there.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. Something else I wanted to touch on was being a World Cup mechanic and the tools, which you kind of spoke on in your early starts. Pretty funny intro to your tools. But you... If I remember correctly, you've won at least one Toolbox Wars.
Yeah.
Is it one or two?
I can't remember. I think I won like the Toolbox Wars overall thing and then like the People's Choice or something another year, some like other kind of satellite competition.
Yeah. How did that come about? I think I only ever heard about it was because I was following you on social and Brad Kelly. Yeah. What's going on there?
Yeah, it just like it became a bit of a kind of thing just to try and like, well, most mechanics like having nice tools in the World Cup, like makes your life a bit easier. And like I've always liked having nice tools and things in general. And
yeah,
like, so it seemed that for this job, which like, you know, paid pretty well and was the pretty cool job, the one thing that you needed to have for it was a toolbox. So I was like, I can just like put some money into that. And still, even in the grand scheme of things, it's probably like $2,000. It's not like $20,000, but
yeah.
I had a crappy toolbox. I bought like the Park blue one with all the tools included as my first one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so crap. It just like was had a load of tools you didn't need and hardly any of the ones that you did.
Right.
And was janky, and I think I flew somewhere with it, and when it came out on the conveyor, it was all blown out and all the tools were everywhere. So I was like, right, I'm not going to do this anymore. So I upgraded to like a nicer version of it and made put all the tools in it myself. And then when John joined the team, he was like also obsessed with tools, and he's like definitely more obsessive than I am. So he was like already heading off the deep end into this tool thing. Huh. And I think, you know, I don't like quoting who came up with it first, but I think he was one of the first to do this like foam cutouts, right, which kind of are ubiquitous now. And he did it by buying this foam that you like pick and pluck and use like a knife to cut it out.
Yeah.
And in my aerospace job, one of my jobs was to like optimize like the workplaces and the workflow of the product through the shop floor. Huh. And for part of that, and especially because it's aerospace stuff is super like you can't have any FOD or foreign object debris, so if you can't have like a nut and bolt like that was just randomly left somewhere because it could go in a jet engine and kill somebody or kill a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So everyone has to be like super dialed, tidy, clean. So what we'd have is these workstations where like the radar or laser or whatever it was you're working on would like travel into your station, and you'd open up the toolbox and it'd have these machined foam cutouts, which would have like tool one, do this torque setting, tool two, do this, da da da. So they were like, wow. I went about getting those made in Scotland for that company. So I was like, I could like, surely there's somebody over here in Canada that can make those cutouts. And I found a guy in Langley who is a helicopter mechanic as his job. And on the side, he's started making these foam cutouts. So kind of went to him, and long story short, we ended up with these like dialed foam pallets that were like all machine cut and everything. Huh. And so yeah, and that was my kind of entry into it. And that was my first edition, and then I like,
and yeah, you won just, with that one?
No, that one I don't think I did. Oh. That was a little bit more janky, that one. It's still pretty nice, but like the next one I was like, right, I'm gonna do this. So I got the foam cutouts made to the same kind of standard, but I got a lot of nicer tools for them. Mm-hmm. And I went crazy there, and like every little tool I like spent time researching and found like the best one, and spent like a stupid amount of money on like a pair of scissors and stuff. And then for the lid, which on my old one was something I wasn't like stoked with, I wanted a sheet of carbon fiber, and my initial plan was to make a Bluetooth speaker like integrated into it. Wow. And Ian, the owner of Cro-Mag, where I was also working at the time, was like made a load of speakers. He's still like really into that stuff and really good at it. I kind of was getting advice off him on how to make this an actually speaker that sounded good. I never ended up going down the speaker route, but I got this sheet of carbon, and I got I made a drawing for it to like have a cutout in it for a tablet, because I was going to put a tablet in there to put my settings in it.
Yeah.
And so I bought a big sheet of carbon off eBay, and I went to North Shore Billet and got Pete to machine the shape that I'd made out of it. And he's like, oh, I've never machined carbon before, but I'll give it a shot. So he was in there late at night trying to like not blow up his machine machining it. And so there was a lot of like work went into this toolbox for no real reason, just wanted to do it. And
how long was that after the first one?
I think it was the next season.
Is it pretty common to change that often, or?
Yeah, I think most people show up with something like, most people are into it and are like obsessed, and strange people like myself, like usually the year after would be like, because you look at this thing every day and it's like your tools, it's your tool, is literally the thing you need to do your job.
Yeah, yeah.
You look at it every day, and like my first one annoyed me enough that I changed it the second year.
Yeah.
But I kept that one for a while because it was really good.
Yeah. But you changed it again. You had a third one.
No, that's the current one I got, yeah. Huh.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite tool?
I think
work on bikes, I should say.
Yeah. Well, the favorite, like the best tool there is for bikes or anything, motorbikes, trucks, anything, is the Nipex, like adjustable pliers with flats on them.
I heard, I think just this weekend, someone in the Fox Dialed series said the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like the best tool ever.
They're amazing. Huh. And like Sander, the head mechanic, he had a set and he gave me a set. Actually, it was like a kind of like handing it down to like somebody.
Cool. And passing the torch.
Yeah, and it was so nice that he gave me a set and he just went and bought himself a new one. And I just remember being like, whoa, cool. This is a cool thing. And like, yeah, that's probably the... I don't, it's funny actually as well, because I actually, now that I think about it, on the YT anyway, there's nowhere you'd even use it. I just like it. So if it was something that I actually use all the time, it would be the Allen keys.
I was going to say, what's your most used? Yeah.
Yeah, just the T-handle Allen keys. And I like the, I had the Facon ones, French ones. They're like really good. They're the best ones I had. I had this, I have the same set. I've had them for 10 years now. They're like,
wow, solid. Still like new.
Yeah.
Cool. You mentioned the Cro-Mag, and I wanted to ask too, as you were telling that story, it sounded like you were living in Canada. Like when you were building that toolbox, you were dealing with guys in Langley.
Yeah, I did. I got my first job on the World Cup in 2013. And at the end of 2014, I moved to Canada. So
not long after.
I did a year or 2 years based in Scotland. Or actually one of those years we spent the whole summer in Chamonix. Because there was a bunch of Kiwis like Brooke and George on the team that year. And rather than fly them back to New Zealand all the time, it made sense to get a European base. And so like Laurie Greenland's dad sorted out this house in Chamonix. So we spent our summer there, which was amazing.
That's pretty sick.
Anyway, the year after I was moving to Canada, and I kind of like, I was doing that anyway. I was like, I'm going to do that no matter what happens with the team. And I went to Martin and asked him, and he was like, oh, it's a bit annoying. Like your flights are going to be more expensive, but I'll do it. So
that was you're worth it.
I don't know. Or maybe you couldn't find anyone else or something. I don't know.
So you moved to Canada, like, and you'd still only been here that one time, that one sort of 4 month trip.
Yeah. I'd done like, I came back the year after for a holiday.
Okay.
And had been here like one time before 2009 for like a skiing holiday when my brother lived here.
Okay.
But yeah, like
you knew
hadn't
well enough.
Yeah. I knew I wanted to like at least try living here.
Right.
Kind of wasn't sure I was going to stay here forever, but thought, you know, I think it's, to me, it's crazy to like, sounds super cheesy, but have like one life here and only live in one place, because like think how big the world is and all the different places and experiences, like why would you like only live one place?
It's good to experience a few. I've always wanted to live in the south of Spain, funny enough, for a period, but I don't know.
It's a great place. I just want to look back when I'm really old and be like, like, and I lived in Japan for a bit, and there for a season anyway, and lived in Scotland and lived in Canada. And I'm like, even if I finished at that, it's pretty cool. But I'd maybe like to live somewhere else in the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's just nice to be open about those things.
Yeah, totally. Did you only work as a World Cup mechanic for at least a period? I know at the end there you weren't only doing that.
I think I tried it because a lot of the other mechanics only did it.
Right.
Only did World Cup mechanicking.
Right.
And I tried that for a bit, but I just got so bored.
Really?
Yeah, like I'm like, I need to be doing stuff all the time, and I'd work a lot now, and I always have. And I had this dream that I'd like train loads and like try and be good at racing enduro, which was something I was kind of into for a while.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, this is a dream. I can like race, I can work at the races in the World Cup, train the rest of the time, and then maybe one of these years I'll transition from being a mechanic to like a enduro EWS racer.
Yeah.
And so I would like had finished the season in September, October, wake up on the next Monday morning and be like, right,
training time,
go training. And I just sit in the house and be like, oh, I'll go at like 11, because then that'd be good. And then I'd get to 11, I'd be like, ah, it's so close to lunch, I'll wait and have lunch, because I'll be hungry when I go. I'd have lunch and I'd be like, oh, I kind of feel a bit like like sleepy after lunch. So I'd wait, I'll just go out in the evening. And I was like, oh, it's dinner time. Shit. And anyway, I just was like, I need that like other thing going on, like work basically. Yeah, so yeah. I tried it for a bit, but nah.
Wasn't going to happen.
Wasn't for me, no.
So you, when I first met you, you were working at Cro-Mag as an engineer there.
Yeah.
And I think I'd spoken to Rebecca and Ian about the staff there when you weren't there, and they said that their engineer Ben is at the World Cup right now or something like that. Yeah. I was like, holy shit, like how does he mix those up?
Yeah.
Like how, well, I mean, that's obviously pretty accommodating for them too, because yeah, you're not around a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, they were awesome for like allowing me to do that. And Ian and I kind of got to know each other on the Cro-Mag Friday rides, which are kind of like an establishment around there. And we would just talk about product, because like Ian loves talking about
his gear,
loves talking about product and like design and stuff. And he's super into that and like super good at it, obviously. So we would just talk about it, and it kind of just germinated into this kind of eventually a job offer after I'd like done a few little trial things.
Oh yeah.
But it was always like, for me, was with the proviso that I was still going to be doing the World Cup. Kind of wasn't like finished with it at that point. And
yeah.
It was like pretty decent money as well. And I thought with like the two incomes, it would like might allow me to stay in Whistler, which is like a super expensive place to live.
Yeah.
So yeah, like I guess that's the way it worked for the first little while.
Yeah.
And the good thing about it worked quite well anyway, because the rest of the year, other than the summer at Cro-Mag and most bike companies, is like all when you get the actual work done. It's when all the design and that work gets done. And the summer is kind of like firefighting. You're just like dealing with the fact that it's so busy and like, you know, you're selling stuff and all of that. So it wasn't, I don't think it was that bad of a time for me to be away.
Yeah.
And I also had my laptop with me. So if there was any like kind of, yeah, and I had quite a lot of time on the World Cup, like in the evenings I could like update drawings or do stuff like that. So
while you're at a race?
Yeah.
Don't you guys work around the clock?
No. Hell no. So I said, Daniel's like, yeah, it's 9 to 5, if that.
Yeah.
My day would normally be like, wake up, go for a ride, get to the pits for like 8 or whatever. Then you'd, the worst day would be like practice day, where practice finished at 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Then you prep the bikes, takes an hour, have a beer, pack a tent up, you're back at the hotel for an hour before dinner. Wow. So you've got an hour always then, pretty much. Mm-hmm. We would normally drink or drink a little bit, as I should say, and then have dinner, and then you got until bedtime. Yeah, so right. It's just like a normal work day.
Yeah, yeah. That's always been made out to be like, oh, they're up till 12 in the morning.
Oh, no, I think just some people love to like over kind of like tell you how their jobs are difficult when, because it makes you feel like you're doing less of a good job maybe for some people if you say that it's not that hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it is hard. It's like, it's hard because you're away, like, you know, you're not going home to your wife or whatever afterwards, but it's objectively kind of an easy job.
Yeah,
like apart from the stress. And
yeah, it must be pretty high stress at times.
Yeah, so depending on how much that affects your life, it could be a really hard job. Yeah. But I don't think you'd stay a World Cup mechanic for long if it really affected you. So it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you do it and you're good at it, you're going to be able to do it with relative, like without too much difficulty.
Yeah. Autopilot kind of thing.
Yeah.
Hmm. So you're at Cro-Mag for 3 years, 2 years?
Yeah, I think about 3 years. Yeah. 2 years. Yeah.
What was, I know we've spoken before about the pedals. What else did you work on there that you can talk about?
Yeah. Kind of like, you know, Ian as the owner and like until I came along, the basically the only designer at that company is like incredibly like accomplished and talented person, has like made every product that they, until I came along, that they'd ever made without formal training in that. You know, he's not an engineer. He's just learned how to use CAD and has like a amazing kind of eye for an aesthetic of something.
Yeah.
And so I kind of just like slotted in and took on some brand new projects like the Dagger pedal, and then also just started like doing a bunch of the, like, you know, any bike company that makes a handlebar, there's like daily emails to the handlebar vendor about like issues with a production or changes you want to make or just stuff like that. It just like, it's kind of, some of it's not very glamorous, but
I was gonna say there's a bit of stuff that's not as glamorous as I thought it would be.
Definitely. Like, and that's like, I think a successful company like Cro-Mag is, you know, is kind of one of its big successes is obviously its product, but a lot of it is then handling producing that product and keeping it like to a level where it's sustainable and like actually working out in the field for a long time. So there's a lot of that kind of going on. So I took on like quite a few kind of new projects, a lot of, I designed and built some test equipment for the handlebars, because before that, all any testing we'd had done would have been in Taiwan, a third party. Which is fine, but we kind of like wanted to bring some of that stuff in house, so we could validate that the testing they were doing was accurate and kind of useful, and also so we could like start looking at how we could improve our products and get a real
bench other people's stuff.
So so that was quite cool. I quite enjoyed that kind of thing. And then I worked on a lot of like frames, you know, like a lot of hardtail frames. We just on, Ian had done all the drawings for all the frames, always on 2D CAD, so the drawings worked perfectly for what we were getting done. But when I kind of moved it into 3D CAD, just tried to make it so they were, the drawings were a lot more like kind of editable. So for example, a 2D drawing, like you could, Ian could go and like make a new frame size by moving around a bunch of things, and he was super efficient at it. But by the time I'd got like the 3D models dialed, you could just like type the geometry that you wanted and press go, and it would like make the 3D model and the 2D model, the 2D drawing. So like it was super, like just trying to like
just efficiency things.
And Ian was like super busy with running a growing company, so he definitely wanted to be doing more design stuff, and I'm sure he still does, but just has like the reality of like running a successful company. So and then you know, I don't know really, they're getting released soon, but I worked on a bunch of suspension frames, and that was something I was really interested in, and I had a lot of experience and knowledge about kinematics and suspension, so it seemed like a really good opportunity to like
flex
or just to kind of like take, if Cro-Mag wanted to do that, which I ran it past Ian and just think it was something he was interested in but didn't have the time or the expertise to do it previously. I was like, I really want to kind of like do that. It's something I'm really interested in, and I know what I want in a suspension bike and what I don't want, and I think I can design it.
So. What's your background on that side? Like, did you spend time in school working on suspension designs or anything?
Not really. Like, I was always into it, and I like helped with the suspension on the Formula student car that we had. Like most engineering schools have, like in the UK anyway, they have like this kind of like little indie car kind of looking thing, and the the engineering students build it and design it. And so I did a bunch of the like suspension work on that, and I worked with our like the department for like dynamics, I guess it was called. So I learned a little bit there, but most of it was from having an interest in it at the World Cups, being annoyed at myself for not knowing enough about it. So just learning, just like reading a lot of stuff, speaking to anyone who would talk to me about it. And like, there's a lot of knowledge on the World Cup if you know where to look. So like always hit up the suspension guys, and there's always frame or bike track people like who had designed suspension systems. And I just tried to read as much as I could. And I kind of got to this level where I like realized I kind of knew quite a lot about it, you know, and like I didn't have to look at something and try and figure out how it was working. I could just look at it and be like, oh, that's why that's happening. And so to go to take the to make the jump to designing stuff, suspension frames, it was quite like, seemed kind of natural.
Cool. Yeah. But that was the first time you got to really work on it.
Yeah.
Was that process.
Yeah. And like when I started doing that first frame, Chromag, I had like no idea what I was doing. Like, well, I had the knowledge, but in terms of how to actually like convert that into a bicycle that like works and doesn't break, and it was really hard. And like Ian actually sketched out by hand, like the, what he thought looked good as a layout for a bike. And I took it and took it into the linkage software that like is super handy. Yeah. Saves a lot of time for like putting a kinematic together and spitting out what suspension curves that's going to create. And I took it into that and I was like, oh yeah, this bike will actually work. So it went from there. So like Ian was actually the like kind of, he came up with the like aesthetic of it for the first one.
And that aesthetic just happened to be a good yeah, bunch of leverage.
That's the kind of thing that happens to Ian. I don't know if he, I think he, well, he's just good at that stuff. I don't know. I couldn't do that. He like drew it by hand and it was like, man, that picture is better than any picture I could ever draw. And it was on like a napkin probably at midnight. But luckily that, well, not luckily, like you definitely had to like pull things around a bit to get the kinematic where you wanted. But there's certain things that just work and things that don't. And I kind of looked at it, and even before I'd started like plotting it out, I kind of had a good idea it would work. So
cool. So that was until recently, and recently you've had a bunch of big changes. The COVID year, from speaking with you, was a bit challenging. And then you've left Chromag, and now you're working at another local mountain bike company. At 1UP. So is that role at 1UP much different than what you were doing at Chromag, do you think, or similar? You're still dealing with sort of my like suppliers and stuff?
Yeah, my day-to-day job is pretty similar. It's like logging onto my computer and opening up CAD and modeling stuff and going in between that and emailing people in Taiwan. That's kind of like the very basic kind of overview. They're pretty similar kind of things. But I moved to Squamish from Whistler in 2019, end of 2019, just as COVID hit. Not because of COVID, just coincidentally. And I kind of thought, well, I commuted for a while, and I watched my dad commute his whole life, an hour each way every day, and he really hated it. And he once told me how many weeks of the year he spent in his car when he'd worked it out overall. And I was like, oh man, like I don't want to do that. And even though it's actually like a really nice commute from here to Whistler, I just kind of thought like, I can't live in Whistler. I can't afford it. Like it's too expensive to buy a house there. And I don't know if I'll ever be able to. So I can in Squamish, or used to be able to in Squamish. So I was like, well, I want to live somewhere where I can like afford to live there. And I don't want to commute. And at the same time, coincidentally, a job offer came, or job posting came up at 1UP. And, something I kind of wanted to do, I would like to do, is eventually gain my professional engineering kind of accreditation. Kind of just as more like a personal goal. Like I don't know if it'll ever help me career-wise, but it's certainly a good thing to have.
So how is that different to your education degree?
So when you, it's like, I don't know how to compare it actually, but you do university, and when you finish that, you're a bachelor or master of engineering. And when you do this professional thing, you you have to do loads of on the job, like show that you've done X, Y, and Z, and convince the body in your country that you are a accomplished engineer and you're a professional engineer. And for some industries, you actually need it if you're gonna like sign drawings off. It's not the same in the bike industry. Like, you don't technically need to be it. It's a bit of a gray, funny area. Like, if you design a handlebar and it breaks and somebody sues you, like, you know, you're not a professional engineer, but like, it's just gray. It's not like, yeah. So anyway, you don't need it in our industry specifically, but it's kind of like been a bit of a goal of mine. So if I'm going to work in engineering, I always want to feel like I'm like progressing and achieving something. And anyway, in order to do that, you need to have one of these engineers working above you or at your company who can like basically vouch for you and mark your work effectively.
Right.
And we didn't have that at Cro-Mag, and I was the most senior engineer there. So it was not an option to follow that. So when the one-up job came up, I thought, well, I can do it there because my boss there now is a professional engineer. So that was a reason. And then, yeah, like the commute and then also just kind of a change.
Fair enough. So you did that, and at the same time you pulled back from your World Cup duties.
Yeah, well, I did the last year of the World Cup last year. And it was a weird year because I went to Spain in March or April, and at the time, like, I was working at Cro-Mag, and Ian had just cancelled his Taiwan trip for that year. And I remember thinking, I think saying to Ian, like, oh, I think you're overreacting. Like, I don't think this is going to be as big a deal as people think. And like,
I was the same way to Oz around the same time.
How stupid do I feel now? And he cancelled his trip very wisely. And I kept going to Europe for this first race. And we were at team camp in Spain before Portugal, the first race. And COVID just like hit the fan, and it's so hard to think of now because it's so long ago and it seems like a dream, but like people didn't know what to do. So all the like airports were like shutting down, flights were shutting down. And there was a time where it looked like I wouldn't be able to get back. And it was really like, I realized that like I love traveling. I love being away from home for those periods. But because I've never had to think of it before, it's basically only with the caveat that you can come back.
Right.
Under your own, you can decide to come back. As soon as that was taken away, I was like, I don't want to be here. I want to go home like immediately. And it's weird because I never have felt like that before. So anyway, long story short, we got out, got back here, self-isolated for 2 weeks, spent the rest of the summer. Nobody knew what was going to happen with the World Cup. Then it turned out there was going to be this little short season. I was like, sweet, well, that's cool. That's kind of salvaged a bit of the year. And so I went, and it just was like, it just wasn't the same, like as you might expect. Like there was way more rules. Like you couldn't mingle with other people from other teams, which is like, I realized one of my favorite things to do is go and hang out with other pits and chat to them and just be able to like do kind of day to day. It just made it really like work orientated. Like get up in the morning. In some venues, they would like a car would pick you up and drive you to the venue.
Wow.
Escort you into your pit.
Shit.
You weren't meant to leave your pit. You had to have a mask on. Like in Austria, the police were walking around like ripping up your tent really quickly and looking. And if anyone didn't have a mask on, you'd get like a yellow card on the outside of your pit. And then if you got caught again, you get a red card and you'd all have to leave the race.
No way.
So it was just like some weird kind of dystopian world that I was like, nah, this is not what I wanted to be anymore. And at the same time, this other job came up. So I was like, well, kind of feel like I should stop doing the World Cup at some point, just because as much as I love it, I don't want to be one of the like 40-year-old mechanics who have like shut off any other avenue by doing it for too long.
Right.
So I was like, this is as good a time as any to like stop. And then it's a fresh start with this new job and kind of just see how it goes. And I also kind of hedged my bets that this year 2021 was going to be the same, like COVID wise. I just from everything I'd read, I was trying to read as much as I could, and I was like, I think I can't see, even if everything goes perfectly to plan, that for the next year's World Cup season it's going to be like game on. You can like do whatever you want. So I decided to like call it that.
So is that it? Never say never, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know, like, yeah, I really, really miss it.
Yeah.
I really loved it.
I bet, like, the race weekends, you must be just like, ah.
Yeah, and the feeling of, like, setting off in the truck on a morning, driving through a cool mountain pass I've never driven through before, and just feeling like kind of, it was pretty good feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
Totally missed that. So yeah, I don't know. Never say never. I'd like to go back, maybe not do like a full season, but maybe like drop in to help out with like Fox or something for a race or two. I think maybe do something like that.
Pete. You know Pete Shang?
Yeah.
He was over there for the World Cup last weekend. Yeah, I was like, what the hell is Pete doing there?
Yeah. Yeah. Do a bit of a Pete, something like that. Yeah. Cool.
Oh, cool. Some of what you've been saying kind of helps me understand how you have so much going on, because you say you like to keep busy.
Yeah.
And you have your own distribution company in Canada as well, Alba Distribution. How did this come about?
So on Trek World Racing, the videographer is a guy named Vittorio, who is an Italian chap who I worked with for years, and he's a amazing, incredible, funny person. And when he announced he was leaving the team, it was super sad, and like I just loved spending time with him. And he went to, he was going to work for Formula as the marketing manager.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it, so it was a great job upgrade for him and all of that. So that was fine. And the next year we kept in touch, and he came to a few races, and he just, he was always, he was very like, kind of like always asking what I wanted to do in my life and my career and future, you know. He's studied, he's got a PhD in philosophy. We'd have some like mega deep conversations. Right. And, so he was always asking me like what I wanted to do and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I'd like to like, you know, have a business and I like doing suspension and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, you know, you could be the, we don't have a service center in Canada yet for Formula, or just now. If you guys wanted to do it and you could set it up, like I'm pretty sure we would be keen to work with you because I know you and all this. So I was like, yeah, and started thinking about it. And I was like, yeah, like that should be really sweet. And I think I could do it on the side, because this is before Cro-Mag. I was like, I think I could probably do that on the side and still keep
the World Cup stuff.
Yeah, do kind of, yeah, tick a lot of boxes. So we started going down that route, and he said, well, if you, it's great that you want to service this stuff, he's like, but honestly there's not enough of it in Canada for you probably to like actually service, so how do you feel about trying to sell some? I was like, well, I don't know, what does that entail, blah blah blah. Long story short, we're like, yeah, let's, we'll try it. And I was living with Matt Cooper at the time, who's my business partner at Alba, and kind of just talking to him as a friend about this idea. And I think he kind of said to me like, oh, I'd be interested in like going in on something like that if you were gonna do it. And so we started talking about that more seriously, and I had some money saved up for a house deposit, and he had some too, and we just put it together and like spent it all on a initial order from Formula.
Wow.
And got it shipped over, and we're like, see what happens. And, yeah. And Isaac, who was the photographer on the team for a number of years, he's like an amazing amazing photographer, but also really, really good web designer. And he made us a website. And we got this stuff and started trying to sell it, and did it out of our basement kind of workshop at the house where we lived. And sold some the first year, probably like a dismal amount if I look back now. But we also didn't like put that much work into it. Like really, we kind of like, I was still working the World Cup, Matt was still working full time. So and then it just kind of grew from there. We just kept like trying to provide really good service. That was kind of always my thing, is like I worked in bike shops for long enough to know how bad shitty service is from distributors. And we also then started selling direct to customer as well, which kind of opened up a whole bunch of new business and allowed us to actually like speak to the people that were using the stuff, which was good.
Did you find that helped at all too? Because Formula has been around forever, but they're not a like big name in North America or anything.
No, and they have they had, or maybe still have to a certain extent, a bit of a bad reputation in North America because of some brakes that they spec'd on a Specialized Stumpy number of years ago, these C1 brakes.
Okay.
And I think basically they were like they're pressured into making higher numbers than they were comfortably able to make well. And I think they basically made some kind of shitty brakes for these bikes. And they were like totally dogged with problems. And like people, bike shop mechanics have like PTSD about dealing with those brakes. And a reputation like that's really hard to break, you know. That's kind of what we've been trying to do, is like do that. But so a lot of it has been like convincing people that this is like a worthy product for their money. I think that's kind of passed now, and like enough people have the brakes and realize how good they are.
Well, it didn't hurt having Loic ride them for a bunch of time.
They were on them for a couple of years, and like Miranda won the world champs on them and stuff. So so that was Formula, and then I got to know the then kind of marketing guy at EXT, who was also called Vittorio, at the World Cups. We would just chat, and he kind of approached me and said, hey, how would you guys feel about distributing this stuff in Canada? And we were super actually hesitant for a while, because we're like, oh, we're still kind of running this out of our basement, and it was going to mean a big step up in like servicing. And I hate doing anything half-assed, so I didn't want to like do it and not be able to provide the service that I would want to in an ideal world. So I held off for a long time, like played really hard to get, and then eventually we're just like, I think we can actually do this. And I had an idea to like set up a workshop at my brother's house in his garage, and like so then we took on EXT and a couple of other brands, and since then it's just grown from strength to strength.
It's just blossoming.
But we're super lucky. Matt and I both work full time at 1UP, which is funny. He works there too. He also got a job there. So
it's funny, because I met both of you at Cro-Mag, and Matt had just started there.
Yeah.
And the joke was that you were a team. You got one of us, you got both of us.
Yeah, I don't know how the hell I fell into that situation, but it seems to be the case to a certain extent. It's still going. We both work full-time and run Alba. Matt works 4 days a week and I work 9 every 2 weeks. So we do have like some time off. I'm in here most mornings and couple evenings a week, and then usually one day at the weekend. And so far we're still managing to turn around repair work and new shock builds like within 48 hours, so we're still doing a lot quicker work than most like suspension houses just now. And we also have a mechanic who comes in and helps when we're like really really busy. But as the business has grown, what's been great is that we've been, especially with 2021 and bike shops not being able to get anything, a lot of them have like come back to us when, you know, we'd approached them years ago and said, do you want to sell this stuff? And they've been either not replied or kind of not really been keen. Now they can't get anything else, so they're kind of like
we'll give it a go.
They'll give it a go. And so we're actually selling a lot more stuff to dealers, and what that means is that instead of selling one shock to one person, which requires like 10 emails back and forth and a lot of time, we're selling like 10 shocks to a shop at once, which is way less like chatting time and more just like getting them ready. And so we're selling more stuff, but our workload hasn't gone up by the same amount.
Interesting. So that's but once lucky. Those people need services.
Yeah. But we're lucky. We have a great mechanic on hand who is keen to help pretty much whenever.
Yeah.
I still really like servicing them and stuff, so at this stage we're able to do a lot more than we currently are. And I don't think either of us are really overstretched, so
that's cool.
That's great.
You like to keep busy.
Yeah, definitely. I'm the kind of person, if I every morning before work I usually do something, either come to work here or ride. And every evening I usually come here or ride, or like go to the lake, or I have like pretty much something like planned, not like solidly, but I kind of know the day before roughly what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And the odd time where I get to an evening and like my girlfriend's away and I'm in the house, I'll just like look around and be like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I can't, I've got like 2 hours to kill before dinner. It's totally like a problem I should probably get help with, but I'll just like, oh, I can write some emails, or I can like update the website, or I can like update all our pricing and figure some, like, you know, make that more accurate. And it's just, don't know, the way I am.
Your busy mind. Mm-hmm. So you're a busy mind, but you still ride heaps. Mm-hmm. How do you, is it just because you're always going? Winter must suck for you because there's no daylight to get the outside time in as well as work.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't know. I'm not that fussed about riding as much in the winter. And actually, it's really, really good at 1UP. They are amazing about letting, or they actually want us to ride like during the work hours.
Right.
So really, as long as you don't take the piss and you get your work done, you could ride every day. Like, during lunch, and you know, it generally ends up being longer than your allowed lunchtime. But there's kind of just a real kind of mutual respect that if you like go for a ride, maybe stay a bit later, or just make sure you're totally on top of your work. So in the winter, like, we end up going riding like maybe at least 2 to 3 times a week during the day.
Right.
So I actually feel way less pressure to ride like in the weird times, like between in the winter,
which, lights and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and like I do that a little bit, but I'm all right. Like, I don't need to do that. And so we ride like a couple of days a week during lunch, and it seems to work really well so far with like the 16 employees there now. Like, some people ride more than others, but nobody seems to get too bent out of shape about it, which is something that's kind of new to me. It's really cool that like people are like that. There's a real good feeling of like mutual respect around there.
That's good.
So yeah, in the winter it's okay, just ride a bit and snowboard a little bit. I tried a little bit of indoor training, but I don't really like it. I just get bored. And but yeah, in the summer I just like, I've always tried to maximize the short time we have here, because it feels like it's winter for like 9 to 10 months of the year here, and then you get this tiny little blast of summer. And so I know what has to be done to like get all the rides in that I want to. And I've always liked kind of like pushing myself and seeing how far I can go riding wise. And so I just,
you've done some monster rides lately. Like, didn't you ride up to Whistler on your full mountain bike the other day or something?
Yeah.
What's that all about?
That was a Friday. I had no shocks to do here. Kind of was kept caught up with stuff, and I had the whole day off. And I thought, rather than do like a 2 hour ride and drive somewhere and drive back, I was like, I may as well just ride all day. So I like, there's this beautiful ride called Jane Lakes in Whistler. It's like one of my favorites to do. And I've tried and have this rule against driving my car to go riding. Like, I'd see so many people around here. It's crazy in North America, no offense to North Americans, compared to the UK, like people just drive everywhere here, like drive to work if it's a kilometer away, or drive to the bike trails, which are like just up a hill.
I find it nuts that people drive to the trails when they live in Squamish.
Yeah, and it causes such a huge problem. Like, if you ride up that road, which I do all the time, you get smoked out by dust, and like there's just cars everywhere, a total mess. So I try not to drive anywhere to go biking, and you have to sometimes. And riding to Whistler.
You're not going
to
ride to Whistler on your downhill bike.
No, exactly. So there's exceptions, and like, So, but that day, I don't know, I just kind of like thought it'll be a good challenge. It'll be quite a long ride. Huh. And I quite like riding on the road. I don't really have a problem with it because I used to do it all the time. And yeah, it's kind of grim.
But this
on
is on your mountain bike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of grim on a big, heavy mountain bike, but like, it's all you know at that time. So it doesn't, you just kind of do it. Yeah. I don't know.
Shut off and go.
Yeah. That's but cool. I don't know. I just like that feeling of like seeing how far you can go. And then I really like the feeling of improving. And like, you know, I might have done that ride a month ago and it would have sucked a lot more than it did a week ago.
Right.
And when you can like, when you get really in tune with your body and you can like feel that improvement, I really, really like find that feeling rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Is that on anything, not just on a bike?
Yeah, I think so. I'm like a person who absolutely, I would say, almost needs to be good at something to enjoy it.
Right.
I'm not very good at, like, when I suck at something, I'm not like comfortable doing it and I'm not happy. Mm-hmm. It's like that with jobs as well. Like, I think with the World Cup or with these engineering jobs I've had, I've like, I only really started to enjoy Cro-Mag when I kind of like felt really comfortable. If Ian had an idea for something, I'd be like, oh yeah, cool, I can like draw that up. You know, if I'd been racking my brains for how I was actually going to do that previously, it makes me unhappy or makes me kind of like
that stress,
anxious. Yeah, so definitely like to be good at things. So figured out that because I don't have that much natural talent, the only way to do it is to do it a lot.
Heaps of it.
Yeah, practice.
Yeah, you definitely spend a lot of time on your bike.
Yeah.
That's good. Cool, man. Well, thanks for your time and joining us and telling your stories.
Yeah. That's awesome. Pleasure. Well, hope it's not too boring. It's kind of...
No, dude, that was dribbly. Awesome. Yeah, there's heaps of good stuff. I'm sure there's a lot more avenues you could go down with stories.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about bike geometry. I can lose my mind on that.
Ben rides a Geometron as well. Maybe another time, part two.
Yeah, totally. Cool. If anyone still survives to the end of this one, we can go to part two.
Yeah, sweet. All right, dude. Yeah, thanks, heaps.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, AJ.
That brings us to the end of our conversation with Ben Arnott. If you made it this far, thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen and let us know your thoughts. You can also check nsmb.com for regular MTB content. We'll be back soon with a new episode for your listening pleasure.